So Psalm 39 is kind of where we've got to in the series. I said it's the 40th one because I did skip ahead and I've done one slightly ahead of time. But we're on to Psalm 39. And it's not a very cheerful psalm. The sort of context is that David is under the discipline of the Lord. He's sinned and he's suffering a rebuke from God. And in that, in the pain he's feeling, he wants to cry out to God. But, as we'll read at the start, he's really conscious of the presence of unbelievers, and he doesn't want to cry out to God in that context. So he has a sense of frustration at the beginning of the psalm as he holds his tongue. This is Psalm 39. For the director of music, for Jeduthun, a psalm of David. I said, I will watch my ways and keep my tongue from sin. I will put a muzzle on my mouth while in the presence of the wicked. So I remained utterly silent, not even saying anything good. But my anguish increased. My heart grew hot within me. While I meditated, the fire burned. Then I spoke with my tongue. Show me, Lord, my life's end and the number of my days. Let me know how fleeting my life is. You have made my days a mere handbreadth. The span of my years is as nothing before you. Everyone is but a breath, even those who seem secure. Surely everyone goes around like a mere phantom. In vain they rush about, heaping up wealth without knowing whose it will finally be. But now, Lord, what do I look for? My hope is in you. Save me from all my transgressions. Do not make me the scorn of fools. I was silent. I would not open my mouth, for you are the one who has done this. Remove your scourge from me. I am overcome by the blow of your hand. When you rebuke and discipline anyone for their sin, you consume their wealth like a moth. Surely everyone is but a breath. Hear my prayer, Lord. Listen to my cry for help. Do not be deaf to my weeping. I dwell with you as a foreigner, a stranger, as all my ancestors were. Look away from me that I may enjoy life again before I depart and am no more. Well, it's traditional to have 3 points, and I've got 3 points today. My first is the longest by far, and that is that training in righteousness is more important than your comfort. Training in righteousness is more important than your comfort. Now, sometimes when we read through the Psalms, we're told the specific events that David is reflecting on in his psalm. Here we don't know the background, when this was in his life, but it's clear from the psalm itself that David has sinned and that he is facing now a rebuke from the Lord, discipline from God. The scriptures do tell us of quite a few occasions when David sinned pretty badly. Think of when he committed adultery with Bathsheba and murdered her husband, or when he sends out Joab to count the fighting men in Israel. Now, we don't know which of these occasions it is, or if it's something not even recorded. And it doesn't really matter. The situation is clear. David has sinned, and God has put him in a place of suffering as a rebuke for him, sort of on the naughty step. And David is clearly feeling this very deeply, isn't he? You can get a sense of the high emotions going through his mind and his soul. The psalm starts with David wanting to cry out in this anguish, but holding his tongue. He says, he'll keep his tongue from sin, put a muzzle on my mouth, while in the presence of the wicked. So I want to ask you this morning, actually, to just have a think. Why Do you think David is so concerned to keep quiet, even though he can barely hold in his feelings as he suffers, as he suffers under God's hand here? So, just take a moment. Why do you think David is so careful not to speak out at the beginning of this psalm? Not a rhetorical question. I'll take answers from the floor. So even though he's really finding it hard, he doesn't want to publicly rail against God's judgment. That's a nice way of putting it. And we get some clues in the text, don't we, that's definitely part of what he's doing there. So if you look at verse 9, and he says, I was silent, I would not open my mouth, for you are the one who's done this. Work. This is God's judgment, and he knows God is right. He has sinned, he acknowledges his sin before God. And I think that's definitely part of why he's so keen to put a muzzle on his mouth, because if he splurts something out, it'll dishonour the Lord. And it will cause others to dishonour the Lord as well. I think there's another reason we're getting the psalm as well. Do you spot any other reason why he might keep silent?
Is he worried that if he talks, he might sin more?
Go on, Psalm. Yeah, why would you say that?
Because it says that I don't want to sin with my tongue. I will guard my ways.
Yeah. So he's worried that actually what he's going to say, although it's from the heart, could actually be sinful. Yeah, could bring dishonour to the Lord. Could give his enemies, I think, as well, reason to slander the Lord or reason to slander him. There's hints of that in verse 8, isn't there, as well? He says, save me from all my transgressions. Do not make me the scorn of fools. He knows there are wicked people around there who are out to get him and who will use his words against him. In this situation. So he keeps silent. He holds it in. And you can get that sense of the pressure building within him, can't you? He talks about, you know, his heart growing hot within him. The fire burned, he says in verse 3 there. He wants to, you know, he can't hold it in. And eventually he does crack, doesn't he? And bursts out in verse 4. But interestingly, by this point, in verse 4, what comes out is probably more measured than maybe he was feeling at the beginning. Not a complaint before unbelievers, not an accusation against God, not railing against God's judgment. But what we get in verse 4 is a prayer to the Lord to help him understand. Show me, Lord, my life's end. That's what blurts out of David's anguished heart. And I guess there's a general point to make there, isn't there, about, you know, when you're feeling that you have to express your anguish to bring it to the Lord and not before the wicked, to bring our suffering to God when our jobs are stressful, when our lives are going down the pan, bring it to the Lord. Even our grumbles and aches and pains, bring it to the Lord. Don't bring it before unbelievers. Well, let's look at why and how David is suffering in this psalm. Clearly David is finding life really hard, and he does attribute this to his own sin, doesn't he? So like verse 10, David says, remove your scourge from me, I am overcome by the blow of your hand. When you rebuke and discipline anyone for their sin, you consume their wealth like a moth. So we get a sense here of some of the hardship that David is feeling. I mean, he mentions God's scourge. That's a particularly sort of nasty whip with sort of bits in it. You don't really want to be hit by a scourge. This is there to inflict serious pain and suffering on people. And I think, you know, maybe part of David's suffering is physical. But there are also indications that it's more than just physical as well, isn't there? That talk about consuming your wealth like a moth, you know, that his wallet is under attack as well somehow. His possessions are wittering away, disappearing. So maybe a loss of comfort, a loss of security. But also verse 2, we get that mental and spiritual agony that he's feeling. In verse 2, my anguish increased. My heart grew hot within me. I just want to dwell on those sort of three aspects of suffering a little bit more. We see those aspects of suffering elsewhere in the scriptures as well. I'm thinking maybe if you read Malachi the prophet had to bring a word to God's people that they were neglecting the Lord. And part of the sort of wake-up call to them was an attack on their comfort, their well-being, their money. They suffered a loss of harvest. You know, the vines were dropping their fruit before it was ripe. Pests were devouring their crops. So, you know, loss of income is kind of part of God's arsenal to sort of wake us up and cause us to see, okay, life isn't going according to our plans. Why not? What's God saying to me in that sort of situation? Similarly, that sort of loss of well-being, the mental and physical and spiritual well-being. Interesting, we get that very clearly in the previous psalm, Psalm 38. I know it's a while since we looked at that, but definitely recommend you might read that at home. It's got lots of points of overlap with our psalm that we're reading today. So in Psalm 38, you know, David talks about some physical rebukes that he's feeling from the Lord. Like arrows have pierced him, is how he describes it. He's got no health in his body, no soundness in his bones, festering wounds and searing pain in his back. Those are the physical ailments that David describes in Psalm 38. He describes mental stress as well, pounding heart, failing strength, but also spiritual. So Psalm 38 verse 4, David says, my guilt has overwhelmed me like a burden too heavy to bear. I am bowed down all day long. I go about mourning. I am feeble and utterly crushed. I groan in anguish of heart. David knew he was under God's discipline. He was feeling it physically, mentally, spiritually, and in terms of his comfort and income and security. And I think, you know, when we experience such things, we must ask the question, is this God rebuking us? Is this God's discipline in our lives? Is he trying to say something to me? Now, not all suffering is God's discipline. Not all illness or pain or loss of income is God's punishment or rebuke for your sin. But some of it is, and we must be attuned to God when he speaks to us. Do you remember the quote from C.S. Lewis on suffering? Lewis says that God whispers to us in our pleasures. He speaks in our conscience, but he shouts in our pains. And he describes that as being God's megaphone to rouse a deaf world. So sometimes God speaks to us in those loud ways in our lives, and we should be attuned to that. Well, David knows it's God's discipline. He feels crushed by that. He wants to burst out and say something about it. But let's just, before we move on to what he says, let's just think, why does God discipline his people in this way? Right, back to the audience. Where would you go in the scriptures to find a really good explanation of why God disciplines his people? Everybody's looking at David. That's really unfair. Come on. We can all answer this question. Excellent. Thank you very much, Chris. That's exactly the passage you're after. And interestingly, it's from the book, which is also quite sloppy about where verses come from and just says things like, oh, somewhere it's written. From Hebrews, yeah. The book of Hebrews. The writer of Hebrews has a really clear explanation of why God disciplines and rebukes his people for their sin. And he disciplines us for our good. This is Hebrews 12. God disciplines us for our good in order that we may share in his holiness. No discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. Later on, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who've been trained by it. So very much, this is no pain, no gain. Sorry, Chris.
Blessed are those who find wisdom. Once again, I'm sorry, that's a little bit. But that whole picture, yeah, of the love, not just a father's love, because some fathers don't really love for some reason, and that's sad. But some really do. And imagine being the one that your father delights in.
Yeah.
And he still disciplines him.
Absolutely. Yeah. Right. Brilliant. So you see, the purpose of God's discipline is to create a harvest of righteousness, but the motivation from God is his love for his children. And Jesus goes on to say, you know, if God didn't discipline us, we would be illegitimate children. It would sort of prove he doesn't love us, right? Yeah, what if you don't discipline your children, if you never say no to them or show them that what they're doing is wrong or how to live right, they'll be spoiled, right? That's, you know, they'll just go their own way. They'll be headstrong and do what they want. Some of the parents are laughing. That's really mean. Right. Okay. God loves us and he disciplines us to train us to do what is right. He trains us to have that harvest of righteousness. And that's part of his love. Absolutely. Thank you very much, Chris. Now, I just want to be clear, you know, that your forgiveness is through Christ. You know, you are cleansed from sin through what Christ has done. But living now, how you live still matters. All right? We shouldn't think, well, we put our faith in Christ, that means we're perfectly righteous now, we don't need to worry about doing the right thing. What we see here in this psalm is that God is inflicting pain and suffering, physical and mental suffering, on David in order to produce a harvest of righteousness. He is training David not to sin, but to do what is right. And that really, really matters to God. That is part of his love for us. He cares about how we live. All right? So salvation isn't just something for the future. Here and now, we are being transformed by God to be righteous. Right. We should try and make the link now to... Oh, no, I was going to do a little anecdote on David Beckham first. All right. So, no pain, no gain. Very much the story of David Beckham's career. Some of you are old enough to remember the 1998 World Cup. And David Beckham got sent off for a somewhat petulant kick against one of the Argentinian players. England went on to lose that match, of course, in penalties. David Beckham was absolutely vilified by the country for getting sent off and losing England out, you know, getting us out of the World Cup tournament. It was all his fault. Everybody hated him. And that was a horrible time for him. But David Beckham's response to that was to work really hard to get better as a footballer and to earn his place back in the England squad. And I just want to quote David. I don't know, we often don't quote David Beckham, but I'm going to give you a quote because I think it tells us about that hardship that leads to a harvest. David Beckham said, "When I look back on my career and talk about regrets, I wish that had never happened." Talking about the World Cup. "But on the flip side, if it didn't happen, I might not have had the career that I had." He wouldn't have been the footballer that he became if he hadn't had to work hard and earn his place back in the squad. And what we're seeing, I think, here in this psalm is that very simple calculation that God is making, that the temporary pain that he is putting David under, that suffering that David is experiencing, will pay out with eternal benefits. He is not allowing you unchecked in his sin. He is waking up David to that reality in order for him to turn from it and come back to doing what is right, growing in righteousness. So God really cares about us doing the right thing. That's more important to him than our suffering or our comfort. Right, back to you then. That's just the first three verses. Then we hit verse 4 where David prays. And David's prayer, when he finally bursts out, when it finally can't hold it in anymore, his prayer to the Lord is, show me my life's end, the number of my days. Let me know how fleeting my life is. So, question for you. When David does finally pray, why is that his prayer to the Lord, to understand how short his life is? Definitely is, isn't it? Yeah. So, to the benefit of the recording, Sarah's saying that, you know, God is great. David is frail. It's very much the contrast that we see. Anything else? I'm not sure he's praying to get out of life, but definitely will pray that at the end. Yeah.
Does he realise he's kind of wasting his life by being silent? That's futile, and so if he can kind of almost quantify the extent of that, that will help him to get out of that. So if you knew you only had a year to live, you might live differently. You kind of understand the extent.
You'd make more of them, and by making more of them, you'd be living in God's ways, I think, is the contrast here. So you're seeing that the brevity of life leads into value more what's eternal, well, I think is the way I'm going to take this. So let's just have a look at what David writes in what David prays in verse 4. Show me, Lord, my life's end and the number of my days. Let me know how fleeting my life is. You have made my days a mere handbreadth. The span of my years is as nothing before you. Everyone is but a breath, even those who seem secure. Surely everyone goes around like a mere phantom. In vain they rush about, heaping up wealth without knowing whose it will finally be. And we get so many, it's like a little mini sermon that he's preaching to himself here, isn't it? And just repeating in different ways just how short human life is. Verse 4, his life will end. He knows that one of the certainties of life is death. His days are numbered. The clock is counting down. You can see that number getting smaller as it goes. His life is fleeting, short, it's brief. It's soon to be over. Verse 5 describes his days like a mere handbreadth. That's just when you're measuring small things, you might use your handbreadth to measure them. You wouldn't measure big things using a handbreadth. It's just a small measure. His years are as nothing. And years might seem long to us, but as Sarah says, they're nothing. Our years are just nothing. Man is but breath. Everyone's life is just like vapor that you breathe out on a frosty day, and in a couple of seconds it's disappeared. Verse 6, everyone's like a mere phantom, like a ghost. Not like some spooky thing, but ethereal, not substantial. They're just a phantom, like a shadow. Their hard work is in vain. In vain they rush about. You can you know, almost laugh at yourself there. Can't you think, yeah, like little ants running around doing what we, you know, what we think is important in our busy lives? Well, it's just in vain. It doesn't amount to anything. And all the money that you manage to accrue, well, you don't even know what's going to happen to it after you die. You can't take it with you. It's just gone. So these are pretty uncomfortable truths to kind of get your head around, aren't they? But there is real wisdom in meditating on the briefness of life, how fleeting it is. And I guess that, you know, like Ben was saying, that if you realise life is short, you start to value eternity more and seek the things of this world less. You realise that the things of this world are passing away. They are only here temporarily. So the things that we crave and that we treasure, the pleasures of this world, they are just brief. They're fleeting. They're not substantial. They won't be here for long. What matters is eternity. So there's real wisdom, I think, in reflecting on that fleeting nature of life. So long as it turns us to God and the eternal things that matter, and that we start to live our lives now in the light of eternity rather than living them for ourselves. Now, I'm hoping you're feeling that sounds a bit like Ecclesiastes. Fantastic. Yeah. In fact, that word Ecclesiastes is translated as vanity or meaningless. You know, repeated refrain in the book of Ecclesiastes is the Hebrew word hebel. No idea if that's how you pronounce it. That appears 3 times in this psalm. So when David says everyone's but a breath, that's hebel. That's the futility, the meaninglessness, the transience, the brevity. And in vain they rush about. In vain, that's the word hebel. You know, it's meaningless, it's futile, it's vanity. Here today, gone tomorrow. Our lives are so short, so futile. So we should stop living for the sinful pleasures that are passing away and start living for eternity. In fact, I'm hoping that knowing that our lives are short will lead us to realize that what matters is our relationship with the Lord, because that is the only thing that is eternal. Everything we have around us here is passing away, but God is eternal. And that's kind of where David ends up, I think, in this psalm. So verse 7, you know, David is feeling the hand of God heavy upon him. He's suffering under God's judgment. He realizes his life is brief and meaningless. And it leads him to ask the question, verse 7, but now, Lord, what do I look for? What is worthwhile in this life? And that leads us to our final point today, that what matters is to dwell with the Lord in hope. I love the fact that David answers his own question in verse 7, doesn't he? So he says, what do I look for? And his answer is, my hope is in you. That is what matters. That is all that matters. My hope is in you. And we know that, obviously, part of our hope is the forgiveness of our sins. We get that in verse 8 as well. Save me from all my transgressions. But it's far more than that, isn't it? David's hope is more than mere forgiveness, if I can say it like that. What David is looking for here is his relationship with the Lord. The world is passing away. The only thing that matters is that eternal relationship with the Lord. And that's what he's looking for. So his response is there in sort of the last few verses, isn't it? And it's quite a complicated response. But he says, hear my prayer, Lord. Verse 12. Listen to my cry for help. Do not be deaf to my weeping. I dwell with you as a foreigner, a stranger, as all my ancestors were. He sees that living here on this earth, this is not his home. He is a foreigner and a stranger, which is why I read 1 Peter to begin our time together. You know, Peter recognised that Christians don't belong here. This is not our home. And David says, I dwell with you as a foreigner as a stranger. This is no longer. How can it be? I mean, this life is fleeting. He's just a vapor. He's just a breath. How could this be his home? It can't be. But he's not just a foreigner. He said, I dwell with you as a foreigner. So although he's a stranger in this world, he's a stranger, but he's with God. He's not a stranger from God. He's a stranger, but he's with God. He's dwelling his brief days here on this earth with God, with the Lord. My hope is in you. That's all that matters to him, is his eternal relationship with the Lord. So I implore you this morning, if you know the Lord, make him your hope and your purpose. Stop living as if this world was substantial. Stop living for the treasures and pleasures of this world. But instead, make the Lord your hope. Everything else will pass away, but the Lord is eternal. And if you don't know the Lord, then meditate on the meaninglessness of your life. Let those words of Ecclesiastes drive you to the point of despair when you realize the only thing worth putting your hope in, the only thing worth living for, is the eternal Lord. However, as Chris reminded us, he still feels the pain of suffering. He wants out of this discipline, this rebuke that he's feeling. And he finishes with verse 13, when he pleads with God, look away from me, that I may enjoy life again, before I depart and am no more. And, I think it's kind of clear as you've gone through the psalm that he's learned his lesson. He's turned his back on sin and has turned towards the things that are eternal. But he still feels that discipline. He's still got that anguish inside his soul. And he's crying out to God for some relief from this. And I guess, look away from me is a funny phrase. We kind of want God to look on us with favour. But at the moment, God is looking at him with rebuke. He's a frown, giving him the hard stare. And David pleads, look away from me. Give me some relief from my suffering. But even in itself, that's a prayer of faith, isn't it? That he knows that the ultimate reality in this world is God and his justice. He knows that it's God who's working in his life, albeit painfully. He knows that he should turn and walk in righteous paths again. And he knows that what matters is his eternal hope in the Lord. But he pleads with God, look away from me, that I may enjoy life again. He wants to dwell with him, but in a joyful, blessed, gracious way. So I hope we've sort of, as we charted through that pain and suffering that David's felt, maybe that's not where you're at now. Maybe it is. Maybe your pain and suffering is a rebuke from the Lord. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's for some other reason. But we should all want to be trained in righteousness, to live righteous lives, to live with God, to know that all that matters is our relationship with him. Let us not crave comfort. Let us endure the hardship from the Lord so we'll grow in our righteousness. That is what counts here. Let us stop loving our temporary pleasures and instead seek those eternal blessings and harvests. Let's pause and then I'll pray to conclude.